officially meet, but I saw you present and do a bunch of interviews at Loop, which was 2018.
Was that the one in LA?
In LA. You interviewed Laura Escuday and her live performance. And because of that, I ended up taking her master track, and it was a great experience.
Great.
You've interviewed and talked with a lot of really amazing artists, engineers, producers over the years, and excited to have you on the podcast. It's an honor.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having
me. For sure. And we were just talking and troubleshooting this call, but you're in Berlin right now. How long have you been in Berlin?
That is a funny story that sounds like it should have an easy answer, and it kind of doesn't. Okay. Because I've lived here twice. This time, I've been here since 2015, but I also lived here from 2003 to 2005. And then in the middle between those gaps, I lived in New York.
So it's been a while.
It's been a while.
And yeah. How long have you worked at Ableton?
Since 2007.
Yeah, I mean, you've got quite the resume as far as all the schooling and education you've done over the years. And you are the head of education at Ableton. You've done a performance at Carnegie Hall and all over the world, performing at different really cool venues. And also, I want to dive into this at some point in this conversation, but you wrote one of my favorite books, Making Music, 74 Creative Strategies for Electronic Music Producers. And I know you can't see this, but I'm holding it up for everybody to see. It's not the cheapest book, but I still think this is probably the best book I have found that you can buy today for anybody who creates electronic music, whether you're starting out or you're more experienced, going through everything from tips and tricks as far as, you know, producing and getting out of your own head and getting out of your own way, and a lot of technical details about programming beats and bass and melodies and rhythms. And there's a lot in here. From A to Z. Yeah, still one of my favorite books when it comes to music production related to Ableton Live.
Thanks. That's great to hear. I think you're right about it not being one of the cheapest books for the print version.
Yeah.
For the PDF or ebook version, it actually is the cheapest book because we give it away for free now.
Oh, okay.
You can still pay for it if you want to from the Apple Bookstore or from Amazon. If you go to the shop, the Ableton shop, we also give away the ebook versions for free.
Yeah, that's an amazing resource for people. Go check that out if you're listening and you haven't heard of this yet.
But I also do recommend the print version just because it was so nicely designed.
Yeah, it's very sturdy. It's a thick book. I've taken my highlighter to it. I've got like tons of scratches and notes all over it. But I would love for people to get to know you a little bit, maybe share your music journey and how that eventually led you to Ableton and everything in between.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, most people's journeys aren't really a straight line from point A to point B. For me, it was like a lot of weird detours, but the detours also eventually turned into kind of loops. I think I'm stretching this metaphor a bit too far, but in many ways, like the things that I'm doing now feel like the kind of grown-up version of things that I was doing at the very beginning of my interest in music. And then a lot of the things that I did along the way were sort of spirals out into tangents or other directions, but then it all kind of fed back into the same place. So the first music that I kind of considered my own music was stuff like Tangerine Dream in the 80s. It's kind of soundtrack, minimal electronic music, predating techno in some ways, kind of weird music for, I don't know, a 12-year-old kid to be listening to. But I was also growing up listening to rock and roll and jazz and things like this. And I was a band kid. Like I played percussion in school band.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, okay, great. And eventually decided that I would try music school. I ended up trying music school and I found like that I felt comfortable in that environment. I was kind of a latecomer to studying music as a serious thing. Like I considered myself a kind of self-taught player prior to getting to college. And then when I got to college, I realized that people knew a lot about things like music theory, and I just didn't. I wasn't one of these people, but I really enjoyed it, and I kind of took to that stuff and then did a bunch of school. Like I went to grad school, and during the time that I was in grad school, I had been writing all of this music for people on paper. So I studied composition, and near the end of grad school, I started to really miss the electronic music stuff that I was doing when I was young. I had a graduate assistantship teaching courses to undergraduates in electronic music. And I found that this was like some of the stuff that I enjoyed the most out of my college experience. So I started seriously trying to make electronic music again. thinking back to the stuff that I had heard when I grew up in Detroit, and thinking about aiming my music in this direction, this landed me a record deal with a small label that was based in Berlin, which is how I ended up in Berlin the first time, which was about 2002 or something, and came here to do gigs to support these records. But I was using Live from version one. And so I found a bug also in that version that was hard for developers to reproduce. And then I ended up being in Berlin and sitting with Bernd Roggendorf, who at the time was the CTO, and helping to figure out this bug. And so I was kind of like in with these people in some way from the very beginning, or from my very beginning in Berlin. The company was quite new at the time. I don't really remember what happened in the interim, but when I ended up back in New York, connected with the small Ableton office that was based in New York at the time, which was run by a guy named Dave Hill. And Dave, he was hiring me. He ended up hiring me to do things like user groups in New York. This is before there was a certification program. So I was helping to run user groups a little bit here and there. And I think it was like kind of one thing led to another. And they said, hey, we need somebody to take over writing the user. And I applied for that job and got it. And that was my first gig at Ableton.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Kind of a long-winded story.
That was definitely shorter than a lot of other stories I've heard on this podcast. Yeah, I know Dave. Mm-hmm. Yeah, writing the manual, what was that experience like? I can imagine that could be a pretty daunting task.
It was pretty daunting, but I didn't have to start from scratch, which was good. I came into Ableton between Live 6 and 7. The manual was already like in a good state at that point. Yeah. It was mostly being maintained by, I think at the time, the earliest versions were written by Gerhard and Robert Henke and people like this. And there was a guy maintaining the manual at the time named Kevin Haywood. And he was a good writer and the stuff was in good shape. So when I picked it up, I basically just kind of had to continue in the trajectory that it was in. I didn't make radical changes. It was mostly about trying to maintain that tone, but fill it out for the new things that were coming.
Yeah.
And I think eventually over time, I turned the tone a bit, but it wasn't a big turn anyway, because it was kind of the way that I written it.
It was already structured.
Which was nice.
Yeah, I'm sure that's very helpful. Yeah, I guess there's no better way to learn a software or program than to write the manual for it.
I think that's probably true. I mean, it was a crash course. When I got hired to do the job, I knew much less about Live than I did after saying, okay, well, if I'm going to write this thing, I should probably read it first.
Yeah.
I knew it pretty well, but I didn't know it to the depth that I did 2 months later.
Yeah.
Like that was my first kind of assignment when I got there, was let's read this thing from cover to cover and really get in and figure it out.
Would you say that process really helped with the Making Music book and writing that, knowing the fundamentals and having that experience writing the manual, knowing the software inside and out?
Well, I would say that the process of writing helped me to write the book. Like having had the experience of doing more technical kind of writing and trying to be clear, trying to, you know, writing and rewriting and editing and reading things out loud and saying, okay, is this the best possible formulation for this concept? Mm-hmm. But I don't consider the books to be that similar, actually. I think of them as covering quite different things.
Yeah.
Like the manual is a software manual. It's designed to teach you, here's what the buttons and knobs do.
Yeah.
And where possible, here are creative applications, here are ways that you might think about making music with them. The book is like the flip side of that. It's more like, let's assume that the buttons and knobs are known to you, or at least knowable. Let's just explore the creative possibilities.
Yeah.
And in that way, I really wanted the book to be as agnostic to DAWs as possible. Like, I don't mention Live in the book anywhere, because I don't want it to be considered a Live book. The screenshots are all Live. Like it's not a secret that that's where I'm coming from, but I don't consider the book to be like the missing manual for Live or something. It's more about creative process.
Yeah, I think a lot of my favorite and most talented producers I know kind of have a really healthy mix of the technical and creative. And I think the book really explores a little bit of both for sure on a lot of different levels.
That's the goal, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the Making Music book, because there's a lot in there. We could probably have 5 podcast episodes just talking about it. But before we jump into that, I would also like to know, will there ever be a version 2?
It's a good question. And it's actually a question that I get asked a lot, and I have been asked that a lot since I wrote the book. I don't have any kind of concrete plan I have a few ideas, but nothing that I would really be comfortable talking about until I could say more than a sentence or two about them without it being.
Sure.
I think the one thing that I would want to do, if I were to do another book that was in this style, would be to reach outside myself more. I would want it to be more about interviewing other people. Mm. There's nothing in the book that's like radically unique or unique to me in any way. I kind of put stuff together that happens to be in my creative toolkit, but I didn't make up things that are like wildly original, I think. But I do think that there are a lot of musicians out there who are doing things that are quite different from what I would have thought of. Mm. I think a second book in this direction would be about collecting other people's ideas. I think this even more now that I've been doing, that I did so much at Loop, you know, so many interviews, yeah. Because everybody I talk to has like their own unique take on everything, on not just the creative part, but the technical part too, like which parts of the which buttons are important and which ones are kind of meaningless to their practice. And I think trying to get out of my own head would be the way that I would want to approach a second version of a book like this.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. That's one reason I love this podcast, is because I get to pick so many different people's brains in different areas of music production, whether it's live or studio or engineering or anything. You know, it's, I think the best way to learn is really just to be able to have these conversations with other people who are doing it in different ways than you are.
Totally. And everybody's doing it in different ways than you yeah. are. Like, that's the thing that's been so exciting to me about meeting people over the years, is that I've never heard the same story twice.
Well, maybe we could talk about some of those things. And there's a lot in here. I mean, there's 74 creative strategies and probably more than that for sure. But, you know, one of the things you talk about is arranging as a subtractive process. And that's something that I kind of adopted into my courses too, teaching, is like filling your entire arrangement with material on every track and then spending no time thinking about copying and pasting and duplicating and then starting to cut out the junk and creating space. And one thing you mentioned I thought was good is it's easier to hear when something is bad in that context than it is when something's good, because you can hear this jumbled mess and you can start to clean it up from there. But at least you have content to work with in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the quote was something like, it's easier to hear if something's bad than to imagine if something's good.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that the particular problem that I was trying to solve there is one that I see sometimes in students who are looking at like a blank canvas, right? Mm-hmm. And the blank canvas is like, I mean, it's sort of a cliched thing now for in all the people that are doing this kind of like creative practice writing, whether it's about painting or fiction writing or whatever, this idea of the blank page as being this intimidating space.
Yeah.
But with a blank page, you could just like copy and paste text into it, but that's not really your material. And the cool thing about thinking about this in something like an arrangement view in live is that given the existence of some material, it's actually pretty easy to just pack the space full of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you can chip away on it. You have something then that's your own. And so the technical process of filling the space is easy. Yeah. And then it's all about creative decisions rather than being overwhelmed by the silence.
Exactly. And that's one reason why I see like Mr. Bill and a lot of other producers doing tons of resampling, and they'll just like automate random like generative parameters, like, and just have like a generative sequencer of things happening, and then they'll just resample and then chop away at it.
That's a great point. I mean, I think this is like, if you think about generative processes as a kind of happy accident machine, the problem, though, is that most of what those generative processes put out is usually not interesting. Mm. But then when you sample that output, you can go in and find the moments. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing I talk to my students about all the time. Like, if you're playing with randomization or things like follow actions or things that will generate large volumes of material, the work then is the work of sort of auditioning it. Right? You capture tons of stuff, and then you acknowledge that most of it's going to be junk. But then you're looking for moments. You're looking for like, wait, that thing, this is worth building on. And that I find really powerful. It's a great way to work.
Yeah, absolutely. You create a lot of Macs for Live devices that can really help with that process too. A lot of randomization or like generative things.
Sure. There's tons of tools for this.
Yeah. Another thing you talk about, another chapter I really like, was formal skeletons. And that's talking about like dealing with arrangement. one practice I also adopted in one of my courses from this book was the idea of taking a track that you really like, copy its song structure, maybe import it into arrangement in live, and then add locators such as like verse, chorus, drop, whatever you want to call it. And then you can delete the track and you have a template, you have a skeleton to work from as a guideline. And I thought that's a really powerful tool, especially for a lot of producers starting out or trying to learn arrangement.
I mean, that's the real secret to it, is that it sort of does two things at once. One, it gives you a thing to start with, which is another way of solving the blank slate problem. But the real trick to that practice for me is that it forces you to do analysis. It forces you to think about the form of the music that you're listening to, because you have to decide where the locators go and what they're called. So then the first step of the process is this deep listening one, where you take a piece of music that exists and you say, okay, actually, how is this put together? Where are the formal boundaries? And then you do the process of labeling them. And that already is forcing you to think about the music in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. That's really good. I love that. Another chapter, you also talk about diminishing returns. Uh-huh. And I think this is something that every person struggles with on a regular basis, whether you're conscious or like of it or not, you know? And that's something I was just thinking about a track I was working on. And as I was prepping for this episode, I was like, this is something I just need to commit to and finish and just call it done. Cause otherwise 5 years right. later, I'll still be working on it. But basically the diminishing returns chapter talks about the final stages of a song are the most time consuming and painful. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find yourself endlessly tweaking what might already be a finished mix. And at that point, you oftentimes are just at the point of diminishing returns. You're making it worse than you're actually making it better. And I've done that a million times. Right. I'm sure I'm not alone. And another thing you said I liked was late stage tweaking results because of fear of commitment oftentimes. And by this point, you probably have already made a lot of the hard decisions that needed to be made. And you mentioned some quotes like perfection is the enemy of good, or by Leonardo da Vinci, art is never finished, only abandoned. And I was like, it needs to be on a plaque, I think, on every producer's wall.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's not just necessarily the case that by making these late stage changes, you're making it worse. It's also the concern that you're not making it measurably better. Mm. Like making it worse, obviously, you don't want to do that, but you might notice that. But the thing that's even more insidious and I think dangerous is like, turn the EQ up 1 dB, turn it back down 1 dB. Like, does it really matter? Maybe in some contexts it makes a difference, but does it make enough of a difference that it's like, oh, that was the secret sauce that this track needed? Probably not. Yeah. If you're at that point, just commit. Like you should be done and moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of my friends, Corey Miller, he's like a platinum mastering engineer, really talented. And one piece of advice he gave me was, if you're playing with something three times or more and you still aren't completely sure if it's making a big difference, then you're fine. You're in a good place. Just move on. And I've kind of adopted that in my workflow, and it's been really helpful.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one. I like that.
I mean, there's a million tips in here. We could keep going forever, but there's two more chapters I really like. One is bad listening. And it talks about like, instead of maximizing your listening environment, such as like perfect acoustic treatment or sitting in the perfect listening position during the creation phase of your track, try moving away from your point of reference, like in the perfect listening spot of your speakers, and listen maybe outside the room or turn the speakers down really quiet to hear the context of maybe the melodies or different things that might pop out.
Yeah. The impetus for writing that chapter actually came from a very specific case that happened to me with a track of mine from a record that I did in the early 2000s, where I kept hearing this tuned cowbell, this sort of electric tuned cowbell-like sound in the track that I really liked, but that didn't exist. It wasn't there.
Really?
Was not in the track. And it was emerging from this like dense... The track was probably too dense, but it was emerging from this like combination of textures. I could hear it more when I would do things like leave the room or take the headphones off, and it would mess up the frequency. But you know, taking the headphones off, you're only hearing high end. Mm. So you mess up the balance that you've been working so hard to perfect. But this sound was popping out of the texture, and I knew that I hadn't made it. So then I was like, actually, I want this in the track. I want I want it to be real. So I figured out, essentially, I transcribed what this pattern was and found a sound that was close enough to it and then actually added it.
Interesting.
But only after a couple repetitions of the section where I was hearing it emerge as an illusion. Mm. And this track cracks me up even today because I hear the thing come in before it comes in, and then it comes in for real.
That's awesome.
And I really like that. And I look for these kinds of moments of things that are almost but not quite there, like emerging as a combination of a couple other textures.
Yeah.
This doesn't apply to all music, because if you're making a piece of music that's really sparse and sort of minimal and there's lots of air and dead space within the track, that probably won't happen. But if it's something that's fairly dense, then the combination of different layers can create these like phantom third layers.
This episode is sponsored by Baby Audio. They create some really fantastic instruments and plugins, and they just released a big update to their cult classic, the BA-1 Synth, that includes an all-new separate effects strip plugin based on its 80s-inspired effects section. If you already own the synth, get the upgrade for free. Right now, you can get 51% off new downloads for this new intro sale. And if you use the code AMP15, which is in the show notes of this episode, you get an additional 15% off. So this is a great deal to take advantage of right now. Once again, check out the show notes. Use the discount code AMP15. Give it a listen for yourself. And a huge thanks to Baby Audio for supporting this podcast. Yeah, definitely. You know, one thing I tell a lot of students is don't clog the toilet of sound, because, and you talk about that in the book too, about like, you know, adding more is not going to equal like a better mix or a better track.
Yeah, there are definitely cases where you wouldn't want to do the thing that I did. You might want to find the phantom cowbell and then work on getting rid of it.
Yeah.
But in my case, I liked what it was doing for the track. It wasn't actually there. So I had to find out how to put it there.
No, there's definitely strange nuances that can pop out like that, unexpected, for better or worse. But yeah, I think generally more cowbell is always better. So,
yeah, of course, the story is even better because it was a cowbell.
That makes it like, perfect. I love that. Another thing you talk about in a different chapter is fail better. And it talks about just the art of finishing and practicing finishing, even if it's not something you necessarily are going to release or distribute on all platforms. The art and the practice of finishing is going to help you in other ways of production, of committing, that whole commitment side that we mentioned earlier. And then you even go into deeper about how to archive like certain tracks and organize them in that way. But I thought that was a good reminder. Like it sounds so obvious, but it's something I feel like a lot of people don't do. And, you know, I have an endless amount of tracks that are only 50% produced, because that's the easiest part, right? It's just the initial creation phase.
I mean, I think that the other thing about it that's kind of important is it's very easy when you're trying to make stuff to get into this kind of romantic mindset of thinking, well, okay, what I'm aiming to do here is create a masterpiece. Like I'm trying to make the best thing that has ever existed. And then invariably, if you have this very high standard, which we all do, you're not always going to hit it, right? You will know at some point, maybe you will sometimes, which is great, but certainly in the process of making a thing, there might come a point where you will realize, you know what, this isn't a masterpiece. And then if you really held yourself to this super high standard all the time, you would throw it out, but then you would never get anything done. So maybe a more realistic way of thinking about this stuff is that if you can get things to a decent enough level and then you finish them anyway, then you can go back and listen to them with fresh ears against each other, sort of assess a body of work and then think, you know, actually this one really is quite good and it balances this one in some way. You have maybe 20 things to choose 7 rather than 0 things to choose 0 from.
No, that's really good. I love that. I mean, there might be ideas too at some point where you revisit that track later, whether finished or unfinished, that you don't release. And you might be like, wow, this lead melody or whatever actually would fit in another track. And so rather than just disposing and throwing the whole thing out, you could copy and paste that into a new project and add to it some more.
Sure. Of course, you could cannibalize the thing and you know, strip it for parts or whatever. That's also fine.
Yeah. No, these are all good concepts. And like I said, there's a billion other ideas and strategies in this book we can keep going into. But I would love to also talk more about, I mean, the education side of what you do. You're heavily involved in education. You've been doing it a long time. What do you think the future of music production education is going to look like for artists? I mean, technology is rapidly changing, AI, all this new stuff.
It's very hard to predict what the future of anything is going to be, right? But I think the optimist in me would say that the future of it is, the future of education will be what we make it. I could imagine a worst case scenario where people think less and less about the importance of like a well-rounded education, including space for the arts, and, you know, a hyper focus on career training as an education model, with a very narrow set of what career could mean. My hope would be that we don't end up in a world where we've narrowly defined what kind of education is valuable. I think I'm an interesting example of a person who didn't study things that were practical. At no point in my college education was I doing anything that looked like it was going to land me a job in a traditional sense. And yet here I am, like I have a job, and it's in the arts. I'm not on stage playing music for people as a regular part of my practice, but I'm doing things that have to do with music and technology every day and getting paid for it. And I think if I had been funneled into a world where I was forced to do something that felt more like career training, I probably would have ended up much less happy and also much less well-rounded. So my hope is that the future of education at least leaves room for people to do things that don't look on paper like necessarily highly practical career training. Mm. Because I think there's a lot of room for people to explore the arts and the humanities and the world. And I think that just makes you a better person, whether you end up doing the arts and the humanities or whether you end up doing STEM.
Yeah.
The people that I work with at Ableton, many of them studied computer science, but they're better computer scientists because they care about music, you know, or in many cases, they're people who studied music and became computer scientists, and they're better computer scientists because they studied music. These highly career-focused education paths sometimes create highly focused people in the sense that they might have blinders on to why it matters to be doing the stuff that they're doing at all.
Yeah.
That's kind of a long-winded and philosophical answer to your question.
But I think that's really good for people listening, especially those who are considering going to college or school or some education for an arts degree of some sort, whether it's music or some kind of creative field. It's not always going to be a perfect trajectory of, you know, oh, okay, I'm going to study this and then I'm going to do this exactly when I graduate, you know, and having that skill set that's diverse, you know, like you're mentioning, you know, people at Ableton are computer scientists. Now they're working in a creative field and their music has actually fueled their skill set that they grew in college. I guess, what would you say, and maybe you already answered some of this, but what would you say to somebody who maybe was considering going to school for music production that didn't want to teach?
I think that's totally valid. I mean, I would also say that one shouldn't necessarily assume that what you have to do is go to school. Certainly not for as long as I did. I mean, I don't think we should normalize not doing a college degree. I think that's fine. Like the world can accommodate people with too much education, less education. I think that there's a place for everyone. And for some people, formal schooling is not the path. That's not going to be their future of education. It might be something more informal, something where they learn from a mentor, something where they learn in a community or with a cohort of other people like them, where they learn by doing, you know, in practical applications. I think those are all valid ways to do it.
Yeah, there's not just always one certain path. I think that's really good advice for sure. Yeah, I went to DubSpot in 2013, but I graduated my undergrad in a marketing degree, and I've used both quite a bit, actually. And, you know, and I learned a lot of my marketing outside of school, and I learned about music production even after DubSpot. So,
sure.
You know, I think everybody's kind of on their own path and just do what you're passionate about. That's how I feel.
If you can afford to do this, then it's great to do it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of like non-traditional options out there now, like, you know, outside of even YouTube, you know, there's trade schools, there's a lot of resources for people to learn from.
This is the kind of thing that I'm trying to do in my job at Ableton now, is like create resources for people who want to learn on their own. They want to get their hands dirty actually playing with things. in a low commitment kind of way.
Well, you've done a good job with that at Ableton. I mean, you have the learn modules on the website. So you have like the learn synths. You have the new tuning.ableton.com, which is really cool. Maybe mention that process of building that, which if people don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the third in a series of websites that I've been doing with my team. There's the one you mentioned, Learning Synths, and then there was an earlier one called Learning Music, which is more about like Western music fundamentals, harmony, melody, beats, these kinds of things. But the idea with these is to create these playful, interactive environments that run without having to install anything in a browser, in any modern web browser. So the goal with these was to kind of meet people at the point at which they think, I like music. Could I make some? What would that be like? You know, for those people who are really kind of coming in at that level, asking them to install a trial of Live is like already too much too soon, because you already have to download something and install it. You need it on a desktop machine. What if you're using your phone primarily? And then you're faced with this like kind of onslaught of technical information. Just getting Live to make a sound requires quite a bit of digging around in the software or at least being comfortable enough to poke at the thing until it does something. And with the websites that we're building, it's more like you can't make them not make sound. Like anything will do something. And the idea is that it's constrained in such a way as to try to limit the scope of possibilities to things that will be enough to get people motivated to do the next page, this sort of thing. So it's quite different than Live, but it's really like, what if we could talk to somebody about making beats and then only look at an environment that's about making beats, for example? Or if we want to talk about an envelope for a synthesizer, let's have a page where there's nothing but envelopes. So you're not confounded by the rest of what a synthesizer has to offer. Mm. It's about like stripping away the things that aren't immediately necessary and then adding them back in only at the point at which you're ready to put them together.
No, I like how focused the website is for the learning websites, and also like very interactive. Like you just click around, you can create sounds, and like you say, don't have to download Live to actually use it. I mean, it's right there in your face. It's very basic. It's easy to interact with.
That's the goal. I mean, with the tuning website, it's slightly different because we didn't really conceive of this as being for a beginner. It's more like a companion for Live. So that site is essentially like interactive documentation for the tuning features in Live 12.
Yeah, I was playing with it yesterday. It was really interesting. Like, I didn't know anything about like 24 equal temperament scales. And, you know, I would imagine it's actually really brilliant from a marketing standpoint to reach other countries like Arabic countries where the tuning systems are so different, and even teaching them through something outside of Live. And then also, you know, having the scale files now integrated into Live, so you can change the MIDI note editor. The piano roll is so different now and opens a world of options for other markets around the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. In our team, we're not thinking so much about the marketing potential of the sites that we're making, but of course it's obvious that these sites work in that way also. They help to bring in new potential customers. And of course, with something like the tuning features, you are now saying, hey, Ableton is aware that there are musical possibilities beyond the sorts of things that are sort of baked into Live traditionally and baked into DAWs in general. They come from a particular musical perspective. They are not neutral blank slates that anybody could imprint any music onto. Of course, that's not true. With enough work, you can find your way into making Live bend to your will, but it has a will of its own. It has, in the design world, people talk about this term affordances. Like, what does the thing suggest to a musician that you can do? And Live certainly makes suggestions to people about what's possible. Now with the tuning stuff in Live 12, it makes more and different suggestions about what's possible. You don't have to bend it so far.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really cool upgrade. I mean, are there other DAWs out there that have the Scalefile integration?
It's a good question. I mean, there's certainly other DAWs that have support for different tuning systems. Logic has this, but they do it in a different way. As for loading the Scala files, I'm not entirely sure if other DAWs support this. But there certainly are other musical tools, other electronic musical tools that support different tuning systems in other technical ways.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I want to respect your time. I know we've been going at it for a little while. I had just like a couple more quick questions. Are there any interesting new tech, hardware, or software that you've discovered that you thought was really interesting related to music production or whatever?
I mean, I'm primarily a software person, and a lot of the things that I find the most interesting these days are people's weird, bespoke, quirky Maxtra Live devices. I mean, of course, there's a lot happening in the plugin world too, but I find that I'm less interested in things like carefully crafted emulations of vintage gear than I am in someone's weird, very personal Max thing that feels like it was made to solve like one person's problem,
yeah,
or to address a particular musical situation that's like super arcane and bizarre. And then it's really fun because I feel like I have a little window into that person's world. Like they weren't making something for a market. They were making something for themselves. Yeah. And then they let me into their world. And that's what I love about Max,
yeah,
that it makes all of this so possible. But I mean, let me give you a few particular things. Like there's a company that makes Max for Live devices, and they're called Fours.
F-O-R-S. F-O-R-S, okay.
Yeah, and they make these wonderful instruments. There's one called Opal, which is maybe the closest thing to like an electron sequencing synth that runs it as a piece of software. And it's just fantastic. It's so well done. The detail is fantastic.
They also make, is it Chiral? Is that how you pronounce it?
I'm actually not sure how you pronounce it, but yes, that's another one of theirs.
That's one of my favorite instruments. Like, I feel like nobody really knows about it, but it's like an MP-enabled phase-shaping synth, and it sounds incredible. It's like this really...
Yeah, the stuff...
Creamy...
It all sounds great. Yeah. It's just made with such care.
Yeah. I'll have to check out Opal.
Opal is fantastic.
Quite a few, actually. There's a lot on their site. Fours.fm.
Yep.
Any other Max for Live devices or companies that you really love?
I mean, there's so much good stuff out there. I think I think it's a one-person company called Madrona Labs that makes this fantastic kind of Buchla in software synth called Alto. I think that's how it's pronounced. Again, what I love about it is that it's quirky and they've developed their own kind of language, UI language. It's thinking in a kind of Buchla paradigm, but it's not trying to look like hardware.
Oh.
That stuff is fine too. Like the skeuomorphic UX, user interfaces are nice, but what I like about this is it deals with patching in its own bespoke way. And I think maybe because I'm a nerd and come from a software documentation background, the thing that really got to me about these tools is that the manuals are so good.
Really?
And you can tell when you read the manual that the thing was made with love, because there's so much more that it does than it needed to do. It teaches you about the world that you're entering from like a philosophical and aesthetic point of view, not just about the buttons and the knobs. And that's the stuff that I really get excited about.
Aesthetically, it's very pleasing. I like the interface of it. I'm looking at it right now.
It's not new. I mean, but it's something that I find that I come back to all the time.
Yeah.
As for hardware gear, like I really don't have very much. I have a Novation Summit, which I like quite a lot. I mean, I really think it's capable of a fantastic range of sounds, but to be honest, most of the time I'm using it as a controller, which is, I feel bad. I mean, my friends at Novation, like you made a great synth and I love it when I use it, but I am often using it to drive things like Wavetable or Operator in live.
I'm kind of the same way. I ended up scaling down and sold some of my synths and everything because I just didn't use them as much. It didn't help me finish music.
Yeah.
This Alto, I'm still looking at. It reminds me of Bangle by Max for Cats.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Good one. I love that.
Bangle's great. Ocelot is great. All the Max for Cats stuff is great. That's people that I know who work at Ableton also are involved in that. Really good Max programming.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. What upcoming projects are you working on? Like, do you anything that you can share that's not too secret?
I mean, I could talk about my personal projects much more than I could talk about my work projects.
Yeah.
I mean, in my free time, I'm making a lot of my own quirky bespoke Max for Live devices. All of them come from a musical impulse. So I make them because I'm trying to do something musically that I can't do. And so I'm using them in conjunction with making music with them. That's feeding two kinds of creativity for me, which I really enjoy. But of course, it ends up like if I get frustrated with the music part, then I go back to the Max part and vice versa, which is not a good way to get things done. Yeah. Maybe I should read my book or something.
Yeah, it's a good book for that. I feel kind of the same way too, from like the teaching side, also making time for music. I find that's a pretty common struggle for a lot of Ableton certified trainers that I've met, is finding time to work on the music, which is why the reason they got into, you know, music in the first place is the love of it, and also spending the time to teach and do work and everything else.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's only so much time.
This is true. So yeah, so music projects, do you have any timeline of when you're trying to release new stuff?
No, whenever it's ready.
Yeah.
Whenever it's ready. No one is asking me to finish something on a deadline. And nothing motivates like a deadline, but
True. It's
all self-directed right now. So when things get done, they'll get done. I tease little pieces of things as sort of Instagram posts, but usually in the context of, hey, I'm working on this Max for Live device, and here's the soundtrack to this demo of a Max for Live device. But it's always music that I'm also making.
Well, I've enjoyed your music too, and your Max for Live devices.
Oh.
Made
thanks.
A lot of really good stuff. The parameter rotation, that was really cool.
That's a fun one. That's now baked into like 12 in a slightly different way as a MIDI tool. I don't think they necessarily got the idea from my device, but that's now, you don't need my device anymore because it's natively available.
I was going to mention that. They updated a lot of existing Macs for Live devices like that into the MIDI clip now. It's just natively integrated with 12, which is cool. It's cool to see that. What would you say, last but not least, like, are some of your more popular Macs for Live devices that people might want to check out?
The one device that I've made that seems to have reached the most people is this thing called Selection Filter. No. And this is, it's interesting that it would be, it's by far the most complex device I've made too, but it doesn't do anything, which is why I think it's sort of funny that it's been so popular. But it doesn't make any sound. And it doesn't change anything about notes. All it does is select them, but it selects them based on musical parameters rather than based on like mouse selection. So what you could do is say, select every D, and it'll do that. Or select every note that's muted. Or if you have a series of chords, select the highest note in the chords, this kind of thing. And these are the sorts of things, I mean, once you've done that, you then need to do something else to actually have a musical effect. But those kinds of things, I always found myself trying to do manually. I'm interested in these kinds of procedure-based compositions where it might be like every fourth note, I want to do something. The idea to make the device came from a couple places. Like in old sequencers, there used to be tools that would do things like this. In ancient versions of Cakewalk, there was this thing called interpolation, which would allow you to modify the parameters of some selection of notes based on some other selection of notes. And in Sibelius, the notation software, you could do all of these parameter-based selections, like select every note that's longer than a certain duration. But there was no way to do anything like this in Live. The only way to select was by clicking things or drag and closing them, or like clicking on a note lane to select all of a particular pitch. But I wanted to be able to do things like select every third note and then transpose it up an octave, because then what you get is this kind of secondary line, right? Based on the notes that you've transposed, but actually making the selection given a long enough clip is like such a pain that you'd never do it.
Yeah.
The other place where I got this idea from was from Jesse Terry, who you recently interviewed, who just mentioned offhand one day, I really wish I could select every offbeat hi-hat in a series of eighth note hi-hats so I could change the velocity of them. And I was like, wait, that's actually kind of a pain. You can't do that
Unless
you manually do it. And that led me down this like year-long path of making this device.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That I actually really like that. And I'll have to check that device out because I could use that a lot. I mean, I do a lot of very intricate drum programming myself. So I can see how that'd be extremely useful.
I use it all the time. I use it all the time. And it's free. It's on maxfordlive.com. There's two versions, one for versions of Live prior to like 11.1, and then an updated version that works from 11.1 through the new stuff. Yeah. So Selection Filter and Selection Filter 2. I would recommend Selection Filter 2 if you're using modern versions of Live.
Yeah, I'll download that and check it out. The other one I really liked of yours that I saw was Note Triggered Modulator, which is...
That's maybe the other most popular one.
That one's really cool too. Because most sequencers are like either just randomized or it's based off of like a time, right? So this is the sequencer triggered by note input rather than a clock.
Right. Yeah, I like this a lot and I use it. I'm really interested in notes as triggers. This comes from modular thinking a bit. And I don't do much modular thinking. I have a very small modular rig and I hardly spend any time with it. But I'm interested in modular concepts, but then taking them and sticking them in Live. Because I really like working in Live, and a note clip in Live is like home for me. But I always wanted to do a little bit more or make it do things that it isn't meant to do. And so I'm trying to infuse some of this modular thinking into working with clips.
I mean, it definitely can create a lot of happy accidents. Love that. So
sure.
Cool. Well, Dennis, thank you for your time, man. It's been great hanging out with you. Been wanting to have you on the podcast for a while. Where's the best place for people to follow you?
Oh, I mean, I have a website and you can just DennisDeSantis.com and you can get to everything from there. I have a YouTube channel, semi-regularly updated, an Instagram, you know, all the usual places, and they all point to each other. So I'm easy enough to find, but my website, I guess, is the thing that I know will be there for the long term.
Cool. Yeah. And I'll include a link in the show notes as well for everybody to go listen. But yeah, I know you're busy. Thanks again for your time hanging out. It's been an honor having you on the podcast and looking forward to all the new things that you and Ableton will be releasing.
Cool. Thanks, Dad.
Talk soon.
All right. Ciao.
Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. Do me a huge favor if you would and hit that follow or subscribe button wherever you're listening to the podcast. If you don't hate the podcast, please leave a 5-star review. It would help me out a ton. Don't forget to check back on Tuesdays for new episodes. If you want to be the first to get new episodes and stay updated and get free new devices and sample packs and other stuff that I'll be sending out in the future, join the newsletter. Just go to liveproducersonline.com/newsletter and or check out the links in the show notes. Make sure to give this guest a follow on the socials. Give them some love for spending their time. And once again, thanks for listening to the podcast. I will see you next time.